The Fed's out of options. Rate cuts, money printing, balance sheet reversals. They call it policy, but it's really panic. This is in-game economics, where hope replaces discipline and the illusion of control finally breaks. They're not cutting rates because things are strong. They're cutting because the system is cracking. Inflation's eating savings. The labor market's stalling. Confidence in the dollar is fading fast. For decades, the Fed built a house of paper. Now they're striking the match that could burn it all down, leaving you to pay the price. When's the last time you actually held the wealth you've spent your life working for? My friends at Noble Gold Investments have been helping Americans move from paper wealth into real tangible assets. Numbers on a screen can disappear, but physical gold and silver, they've outlasted every crisis in history. Visit NobleGoldInvestments.com and get your free wealth protection kit today. That's NobleGoldInvestments.com for your free wealth protection kit. Discover how simple it is to protect your future.
Past performance may not be indicative of future results. Investing in precious metals, including gold, involves risks. Consult with your tax attorney or financial professional before making an investment decision.
Hollywood Godfather, roll the reel, best of 2025, every truth we feel, turn it up, feel the power inside, this is the moment, nowhere to hide, and I
for some crazy reason, I got involved with the invasion of Cuba because Joe Kennedy wanted his son. What?
When? Back
when Joe Kennedy wanted his son to become president.
So
I was on the road. I was 17 years of age when I was at the inaugural.
So you're talking the Bay of Pigs in 1960?
Yes, hello. Wow. And that's why they'll never let the Warren Report out.
Yeah.
Because if they ever let the Warren Report out, everybody would lose their faith in America.
Yeah, I know.
The problem that went, nobody realized once his son was going to become president, he wanted Bobby to be attorney general.
Yep.
And Bobby hated everybody that got his brother in office and went after everyone. Well, the deal Joe Kennedy made during Prohibition with my good friend who acted like my father, who's I'm living in his apartment yet, Frank Costello, they amassed $30 to $50 million each in the 30s during Prohibition.
Wow.
So when Joe said, get your people to back my son, the first Catholic president, which nobody ever thought we'd have, and obviously they said, well, what is in it for us? He said, as soon as he's in, we will invade Cuba, because they were saying Cuba had Russian missiles on it.
Right.
Well, Bobby convinced his brother the day of the Bay of Pigs to call off the airstrike. Why the Warren Report will never, ever come out, and every president buries it once he reads it. They annihilated 2,900 of our troops in one day. 2,900.
Yeah.
They don't want nobody to know that. Now a couple of people do, our audience.
And you know Johnny Roselli, Jimmy the Weasel, Fratiano, James Brading. They were the hit team in Dallas.
I know all those guys.
Caltex building. They were at the Grassy Knoll. They were behind the wall. Right. They were sent to kill Kennedy.
Kennedy was never getting off of that knoll. LBJ had the Texas Rangers as a backup.
Yeah.
And my good friend, unfortunately, I could talk about it now, statute of limitation. When they found Johnny Roselli chopped up in a 50-gallon drum.
Miami Harbor.
In Miami Harbor, while I was having lunch with a very close friend of mine, he always, one thing about Johnny, he always had major church monogram, but not little letters, big letters. So when they put him in the bottle, he got rigor mortis. They cut off his legs and stuffed him in. And as a joke, they put on the barrel JR.
Oh my.
So now, a couple of months, the barrel breaks loose. And it's floating in the harbor.
God.
We're at the 79th Street Causeway. I'll never forget it. Having a place for steak. We're up all night. And we're there outside on the patio. And here's the barrel. It comes up about 50 feet away from us. We couldn't get out of there fast enough.
Tell me about, I saw you riding in Arizona in these driverless cabs. Those are fancy cabs. They're Jaguars, right?
They're Jaguars, but they're at least 100 times safer than having a human being drive them. At least. They had 2 billion miles of research, and they've been using tractor trailers from San Francisco to Philadelphia driverless for the last 2.5 years. They have an emergency guy in it, but they have not had to use the emergency guy once. They don't speed. They're not distracted. They don't break any laws. They give way to, you know, when things are in front of them, they stop. It's fabulous, and it's going to be cheaper than anything else. So that means it's going to be successful. There's no human being. It's going to change the auto insurance world. It's going to change parking garages. They say it's going to be an economic disruptor like the smartphone was and like the internet was. It's going to change the American economy. And
you were in those cabs.
Oh, yeah. It was great.
You're the only person I know that was actually in it. Are you comfortable that there's not a driver there?
So comfortable.
Really?
Yeah. No music, no smelly guy, nobody with banana peel in his hat. You know, it was like, it was great. And I took Alexa. We were in Arizona, and that's where they started testing them with, I said, 2 billion miles. Tesla and Google. Waymo is owned by Google. They started testing these cars like 5 years before 2020. So that's 6 years ago.
Wow.
And they've been testing them in Phoenix, Denver. So I was in Phoenix. They were all over the place. I took it multiple times. It everything's on your phone. It comes. It's got your name on top, you know, on a blue thing. The doors only open as you approach the car. They unlock from your phone. And then you can lock them right away when you're in the car. There's an emergency button that it'll just pull over. There's another button where you could talk to somebody at Central, you know, but you can call 911 anyway, but I love it. And wow. They say to take a driverless taxi from New York to Washington, D.C. when it's available will be a quarter of the price of a coach Amtrak ticket. And you can do your work. Wow. You can make out with your girlfriend. You know, it's like, who's you can move into the car and just drive around for 6 days. It's probably cheaper than rent.
Well, and they're nice cars. They're driving around in a Jag.
It's a Jag.
That was my first thought, Gianni, as I thought, were you uncomfortable the first time you got in it? Were you a little bit apprehensive or just?
I'm not that kind of guy.
He's an adventurous. He's going for it. And if I'm in the back of his mind is saying, look all the money they spend on research. If there's an accident, I'll own this company.
That's true. Like, but then again, who do you sue? The company. You don't sue the driver anymore. You don't.
Yeah.
And only one person died in the research. This old lady got hit in the crosswalk. One. You know how many people die every day in the United States in auto accidents?
Oh, my God.
Every day. They've had 2 billion miles and had one death.
That's incredible.
If you go on YouTube, LBJ's mistress, who's pretty good looking, she interviewed and she goes, the night before Kennedy got killed, LBJ walked into the hotel room in Fort Worth, not in Dallas, the night before. He goes, I'm never going to have to deal with those sons of bitches again after tomorrow. He basically told his girlfriend they were getting killed the next day. Like, why would she lie? Why would she make this up?
Of course. No.
Make it up. There's no reason. And he was like, LBJ was like, I'm not going to have to deal with these two assholes tomorrow.
Oh, he hated them.
And I reported to work and Larry Hagman said, do you know your jokes? And I said, my jokes? I was like, really, my jokes? He goes, your lines, silly. I said, I know my lines. I know your lines. I know everybody's lines. I have a photographic memory. He goes, oh, really? Well, we might have to put that to the test later. So, we all got along famously. And let's just put it this way. You know, you've heard of those martini lunches.
Oh, yeah.
Well, one day there was the few too many martinis at lunch, I think. Not me. I wasn't drunk.
Not me.
Not me. Larry would go, come on, let's have some champagne. And I would go, I can't. Not until I'm done with work. I cannot do that. So there was a few martinis in, you know, involved in this luncheon. And after lunch, we were in a scene together. So all of a sudden, you, Gianni, you know what this is, going up. When somebody's eyes roll up into their head,
oh my God,
for divine intervention from God to teach it, to tell them what their next line is, it's called going up. So I see Larry go, and I leaned in and I whispered his line. He goes, my God, you really did memorize my lines. And then he snapped back into JR's mode, just as smooth as JR is. Darling, blah, 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 you know, and he delivered his lines. I think that's could have helped me get past the 10 episode marker. And basically, I lasted for 5 years until the show ended.
That's amazing, though. I mean, series.
And then I chose to be killed off on Dallas because I got pregnant with my first child, Luke. And I married Bobby Ewing with the biggest hollowed out bouquet of flowers. I did a really low neckline and a mini skirt. And I thought maybe nobody will notice this big belly bump of flowers. But no, I asked, I said, Leonard, I'm never going to be a first time mom ever again. So I want you to give me the most amount of money for the least amount of shows and kill me off in grand fashion. And he goes, well, okay. So 5 weeks into my motherhood, I had a little 5-week-old baby. Off to Paris, we went to shoot The Honeymoon. And because I had him on our hiatus. So I took my mom with me. She's the only one I trusted with my little newborn. And we shopped for 5 weeks. And true to his word, he took me out in grand fashion. I got machine gunned down on my honeymoon in Paris.
Now let's talk about Chuck Norris, because I got to meet Chuck. Chuck and I were, I had a house in Tarzana.
Uh-huh.
And he lived there. I used to see him
all the time. Yeah, he did. Yeah, so he lived there for a long time.
I have a lot of respect for him. But how, I have to figure out when I did that show.
I'll Google it.
I know, since I got back, I got a check and it said Walker's Texas Ranger. I forgot when I did it.
You know, that's got to be the fun part about you guys.
Out for us, because I got to figure out what episode and I want to go back and look at it. I want to watch it.
Well, I'm sure you could pull it up. I know I was there. I was there like for 10 days.
Yeah, we would shoot 7 working days. So you probably, you were there over the over the weekend too.
Right.
So you did 5 and then probably 2 more the following week. Chuck is just an amazing.
Oh my God, nice man. Really a nice man.
He's so kind and so wonderful. He's exactly who you think he is. He's a proud American. He's a great family man. He loves his country. He's kicking drugs out of America. He has his Kickstarter program. He brought all these inner city school kids. He put his black belts in some of the toughest neighborhoods in Houston and all around the state of Texas. And he got these kids to not be in gangs and to become part of the Kickstart family.
Oh, wow.
So these kids went from hoodlums with switchblades and knives. He brought them on the show. He had them perform on the show, a lot of them. And so many, I watched them over the 9 years. They were all going on to get scholarships to college. They were just super smart kids, but just didn't have
the guidance.
Didn't have the guidance. They didn't have that family connection. Wow. And this is what gave them a family. They belonged to something that was respectful, and you know, they gave up their hoodlum gang ways and they became part of the team. And he's done a lot of really, really wonderful things. And you know, Chuck he's the real deal. He won 9 times at Madison Square Garden, the World Karate Championship. So he's not messing around. He is.
Oh no, I know he's real. I know. I mean, You know, I met, you know, the Steven Seagals and all those people, but he is definitely serious. You don't play that game. And he don't even want you to know that. He's just...
Him and Bruce Lee. They're the two...
Yeah.
Two top guys.
Yeah, I just, you know, I did the right thing, but I hit the streets when I was 12. I don't know if you know that. But I spent the first 6 years of my... Not the first six, the second 6 years. From 6 to 12, I was in the polio ward, quarantined, in Bellevue Hospital in New York City. I was totally paralyzed.
What?
Until the last 2 years of my life. Then I got was part of the Jonas Salk vaccine. And yeah, and how I got out of the hospital is even more bizarre. I'm now cured, ready to get out of the hospital, and a pedophile attacked me when I was 12. But I mean, if anybody, a lot of, for, in the book. Oh, it's in the book. That's right.
You got the book.
Wait, you read it in the book.
I can't wait to just.
Sheree, I killed a guy when I was 12. And they let me out. Instead of putting me in an insane asylum, they let me out of one.
When I was 12 years old, my cousin used to live on Mott Street downtown. And he had the balloon stand with the darts.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
He got me a job. He said, I want you to work for me. I want you to blow up the balloons. So I used to blow the balloons every once in a while. Yeah, every once in a while. You know, he come in. One day he walked in and slapped me in the back of the head. He said, listen to me. When you blow up the balloons, stretch them first because you're making them too hard. And I want the darts to bounce off the balloons. I don't want it to break the balloons.
Right.
Cost me too many Cupid dolls, he said.
Oh, my.
That's wild, man.
Well, you had Little Star. Now you guys wrote it. Is that right? Did you write the song?
Yeah, I wrote it with one of the other members of the group. There were two of them. I'm sorry. What was that, Jeannie?
I was just saying.
I didn't hear what you said, Jeannie.
I just said it's amazing you guys wrote this big hit at such a young age. 16 years old.
Well, when you go, if you go to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, we have an exhibit there in the Hall of Fame since the day it opened. And there's a section there with the doo-wop section, and the particular display they have is a photo of us. Little Star is there, and a quote from me. And the quote was simple. It was a question asked. It was, how did you first you know, come up with the song. And the truth was, we used to, and Johnny remembers Pat Crescito, you know, Pat, Patricia, she was a first lead singer. I had a group before the Elegance when I was 14 years old. And we used to rehearse in her house on Sand Lane. And one day we were rehearsing, and it got to be really late, almost 11, 12 o'clock at night. And we started getting tired. We started getting silly and stupid. So we started doing Mary Had a Little Lamb and Little Jack Horner, you know, and so on and so forth. And then we did, you know, Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star. And then we looked at each other. And, you know, two of us said, you know, that's got a little hook that we could possibly do something with. Let's go home. We'll do something tomorrow. So we went home. And the next day, Artie Venosa, who was the first tenor in the group, we got together. Within 20 minutes, we wrote Little Star.
Oh, wow.
You know, and then... all that ad libbing I did, the whoa, whoa, whoas, we added that, and you know, and next thing I know it, we started winning contests at all the local dances with that song. Remember St. Anne's Dance, G?
Oh my God, Friday nights.
Dung and Hills, that's it. Well, there we won a contest there, and it was a record contract, and we went, and of course it was a scam, you know, we signed with them, and it was one of those deals. The only thing we got out of that was, I mean, we got out of that contract because the guy that owned the record company wound up getting shot and killed in the Lower East Side. And all of a sudden we were available. You know, that was it. You know, so we started
That's the way business was done then.
Well, that's it. There was no handshake. It was just a open fire. You know, that's it. I'll tell you one of your stories. Okay, we're in the Club Trio on Sand Lane.
All right.
And this Rolls Royce pulls up. and a Japanese girl comes out with a micro mini skirt and opens the door, and who comes out of the car? You. You know,
she was my driver.
We were hysterical laughing. We were rolling on the floor.
Well, you know, I was always trying to go to the next step.
Do I know that? Who had a leopard instead of a dog in his apartment house? You know.
The first project we worked on acting together was at the Drake Hotel. We stayed there for a long time on and off. We shot in Joliet, Illinois, in a prison.
Oh, that's right. Prison Break.
We were in a bunch of episodes. Ratner. Yeah, we were the two mafia guys.
it's so funny because when Brett got me that part, and I remember every Sunday we used to fly into Joliet and then truck us out to a prison.
Oh.
Now, most people who know me, I belong in prison, but I never wanted to go. And here we were, Gene, we were shooting this thing, and this is even before it aired. I think we did the pilot or the arc or something.
Yeah, we did the whole first season we were
in. So now Brett Ratner comes. I called him. I said, come to my dressing room. I knew Brett since he was a little kid. He thought I was his father. It was funny. I met him at Caesar's Palace about 5 or 6 years of age.
Wow.
And his mother and I were going out, but he thought I was really his father. So every day he'd come and sit with me, and I'm with Sinatra, everybody in the back at the pool. And every day I'd give him a black chip. He thought it was like, that's $100. Then he'd tell me once I might give him a black chip because I took it from the casino. They gave him to me because I gave it away to the kid. When he went into the store and came back with all this cash, that was it. He was convinced. I said, I'm not your father. Leave me alone. And then he used to go around the hotel. Dad, I said, stop doing that. Now look, he turned into a great director.
Yeah. He works all the time, does good stuff.
But long story short, I asked him, I said, I want out of this. He said, what are you talking about? This is going to be a big series. I said, hold it. All my life, I worked my ass off to stay out of prison. Now I'm flying every Sunday. Remember, we stayed all week.
Yeah. And there were two electric chairs. There were two electric chairs still there. Remember those electric chairs with the leather straps? It was unbelievable.
And right outside our trailer was the prison gates with real prisoners in the yard. And it was the worst location because you had nowhere to go at night.
Yeah, that's true. And you, I remember all the time, and every time I worked with you, you were like, I don't want to work anymore. I want to relax. Seriously. You were always like, you were always funny about that. You were like,
and I get a lot of calls, not like you, but I get a lot of calls because of The Godfather.
Yeah, because you're you.
They give me this whole spiel, and I said, why would I want to do this?
Yeah, I know. Great.
I mean, Al, when you see this, my researcher, Mike Austin, is amazing. He found a picture of me at 12 and a half years of age selling ballpoint pens in front of the Sherry Netherlands Hotel, still with my gimp arm. My left arm was still, deformed. But today you can find anything you want. It's insane.
Yeah, if you look hard enough.
That
was on the internet somewhere? Oh, my goodness.
They found it. And then they found another picture of me in a full body brace in 1949. Unbeknownst to me, I was the poster boy for Franklin Delano Roosevelt for the March of Dimes.
My God.
Because I was a ward of the state, so I didn't have to get permission from anybody.
God.
I have all this stuff in it. It's insane. But
so I was, as I looked through some of the stuff about you, I thought you and Gianni reminded me a little bit with your passion for cars. Because Gianni's had a handful or two at a time. And you have a Rolls Royce.
Oh, thank you. I used to collect them at one time.
Yeah.
And we had a hangman. I come from Leicester in England. And there was a hangman in Leicester who'd hung 200 people, And I had his car. Mm-hmm. So I bought his car. I had his car. I had Princess Margaret's car. And people like that, I collected those kind of vintage cars, and they're all gone now. But I have a couple of Rolls Royces left now.
Gianni's had a car buying problem himself. How many were yours Bentleys?
I just sold 60 cars that I had in my house in Mexico.
How many?
60, 60.
Oh, you beat me hands down, man.
Oh, no way. No, but every car I bought, I kept.
Oh yeah.
That's where I made the money. I had a Steve McQueen Goldwing.
Oh, really?
Forget what I got for that car.
Really?
No, but it's funny because Rupert Murdoch was building the studio in Baja. So I said, I got, don't worry, I'll cover you with the construction. All I got, because I was good friends with Aguero, the president of Mexico at the time.
Uh-huh.
So we got a lot of permits done and all that for him. And while they went, and he bought the property next to mine for his own residence.
Yeah.
But he didn't know I had a subterranean garage, two stories, 30 cars on each floor.
Mm-hmm.
But I put them on treadmills. I bought old axles. So I didn't want anybody running the cars on the street. So they'd fire them up.
I see.
The exhaust stuff went out the window. People couldn't believe I had cars on treadmill.
Oh, my God. That's amazing.
No, but that's why I got so much for them when I sold them. They were great
people. So you left them in Mexico, did you?
Yeah.
Jimmy and Tommy Dorsey?
Oh, hello, yeah.
You remember the brothers that one played the trombone and the other one played the sax?
I remember. They were the ones that Sinatra said that's the ones who taught him how to breathe.
Yeah, well,
he could never understand it. And they took the time, like Sinatra did. You know, I went to Sinatra's house.
Yeah.
When I called I said to the old man, said I can come and sit. And she said, okay, let me make a call. She calls me back. She says, come on Tuesday and bring a bathing suit. I said, wait a minute. I said, I want to learn how to sing, not swim. She said, bring a bathing suit. So I didn't know. I didn't know what was going on. I get there, Harry opens the door, and he looks at my hands. Where's your bathing suit? I said, what's with the bathing suit? I want to sing, not swim. He said, put a bathing suit on, and I'll be right out. And here he comes with a cup of coffee and a white robe. He said, get in the pool. I said, what's with this pool? And I'll never forget what he said. He said, if you can't breathe, you can't sing.
That's right.
Yep. And for 3 days, he said, submerge yourself, hold your breath, and keep building up your diaphragm, your lower and upper diaphragm. Without air, this is an instrument, he said.
Yeah.
You got to blow through it. I never got that, man. But
he had his own inimitable style, which, of course, was went around the world. And yeah. I met Frank many times, and I went to his house. I used to play at his golf tournaments, and afterwards he'd have this congregation at his house, and we'd all go then and then get up and sing and do that thing, entertain him for the night.
Yeah, he was one of a kind. A lot of people didn't like him, but I got to know, you know, at 1:30 in the morning, it's time to go if he's drinking, because he thinks he's 6'4" and he wants to pick fights with people. It gets so crazy.
I bet, yeah.
You really tell the story of Costello and Genovese and that I guess, you know, rivalry and bitterness and the hatred.
Oh, I know. Well, you know, I know the story first yeah. Because I remember it well. One day I'm with him, and the next day he has a bandage on his head.
1957?
Yeah.
The shooting?
That's when I met him earlier on. That's when I started working for him. I was working maybe 2 or 3 months, just as a messenger. And I heard it on the news. So that morning I was wondering if he was going to show up, and here he comes with Blackie. He had a bandage and he still had his fedora on.
What did he say? Remember what he told you?
I distinctly remember. I said, what happened? He said, I had an accident. That was it. He got, one thing about him, he never talked about much.
Yeah.
Especially about his business. And that's why he lasted as long as he did. But on the earlier days, you know, when he put me on the road to go out with Joe Kennedy, because Joe Kennedy and he were partners during Prohibition. And they say they made $30 million each. It was well over 50 million each.
Wow.
In the 30s.
Wow.
So I was at Peacock Alley where he used to hold court every morning before he went into his street business. And he did his legitimate business there. And I remember waiting under the clock, and there was all kinds of commotion of this guy going in back there with him to talk. And it was Joe Kennedy.
Wow.
And Joe Kennedy, that day, asked Frank to get his friends to back his son. Mm. And he knew to get a Catholic nominated for president in the Democratic Party was next to impossible. But most of the world, and fortunately now, Trump, who I know well for 38 years now, he's the first one that's letting out the Warren Report. The Warren Report has never been released. You know that better than anybody. 61 years. He let it out. When they hear what's going on in that, and they realize they called off the Bay of Pigs, we lost 2,900 soldiers that day. They got annihilated in Cuba. Because Bobby told his brother, there's no Russian missiles there, and we're not going to invade it. But the invasion, he never told his brother what it was for. They had to invade Cuba to give the mob back the casino. That was the pay for them.
Yeah. And Russell Buffalino supposedly went back. He had $1 million hidden or buried. That's the story that I heard.
Right. You got that right.
That's the thing about Costello, and I've been thinking a lot, Johnny, about what is so different about Costello. He made organized crime kind of, don't take this the wrong way, he made organized crime respectable. He was dapper, and he was out in the streets, and he was in Peacock Alley or the Waldorf. You met him the very first time coming out of the Sherry Netherlands. He had that right. Magnificent penthouse apartment in the Majestic. And he rubbed shoulders and was in business with the politicians in Tammany Hall. And you really haven't had anyone like that since him. I think style-wise, you look at him, I am reminded of John Gotti, fashion-wise, only fashion-wise. In
well,
the
John
way
Gotti, you know, I watched the whole transition to John Gotti. John Gotti became fashionable after you saw The Godfather. Up until then, he wore sweats every day. The uniform for the Howard Beach mob was those sweat outfits.
Yeah. One day I'm on 57th Street, and everyone's in suits, and there's a guy in a tracksuit. He's got a white tracksuit with the stripe down the arm. He's got sneakers. I'm like, all right, there's a guy. What is he doing here? He just walked off 86th Street in Bensonhurst. Why is he on 57th Street at 6th Avenue?
I know.
And you know what it was? I look. Tony Bennett. And I said, hi to Mr. Bennett.
Well, Bennett, Bennett was not a mob guy.
I know.
He used to walk east and west all the time. Of course, his daughter, Antoinette, lived on the east side.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's why? Okay, no, it's a thrill.
That's what it
thrill,
was. I used to see Tony all the time.
Yeah, thrilled to meet him. What a New Yorker. I know I'm sidetracked off of Gotti fashion. I think they had two separate legacies in organized crime. Gotti, in many ways, brought it down. In the other way, Costello, with being accepted by high society, in business with top people.
Well, that was his whole thing.
That's why
he bought the house in Long Island. His neighbors hated him. They didn't know who he was until they found out. But he was knob-hobbing with everybody.
That's the North Shore. That's all the WASPs in the North Shore. The Vanderbilts and everyone else.
And look,
1949, he's on the cover of Time magazine with the drawing had nickels and money coming behind him. Just think, that's 1949. That's 2 years before the Kefauver hearings.
I know.
They had to show the close-up of the hands because he didn't want to be seen, which actually turned out to be worse and make him look even more guilty.
Oh, it was wild. Yeah.
You remember that? Did he say anything to you about that?
Oh, no, we talked, you know, one thing about him and I, because I was the child they never had. Loretta and him had no children. So he, you know, when I was bringing in envelopes every day to the COPA. And, you know, that was the hub for whatever. I knew what it was, Shylock money, numbers and all that. So it was easier to leave the pays there or at Lindy's, because Lindy's was open 24 hours a day. So that's all I did. But I saw right away what he, like you said, he was a gentleman of gentlemen. Never raised his voice. I used to see him every day at 4 o'clock at Toots Shores.
Mm-hmm.
Toots Shores was the place to meet. That was, you met anybody who was anybody. And that's a time when Jackie Gleason was doing the Gleason show at CBS Studios, where all these Colbert, all of them, and then they owned that studio forever. But I mean, I used to go there and met everybody because of him. Once they knew I was with Costello, I could walk on water with these people. Even Sinatra. When I first met Sinatra, I met him in the Copa, and I was listening to him for 3 years on the phone on the radio, because before that I was listening to Caruso. But then Gambino, who I thought was my uncle from the neighborhood, because we called everybody Uncle Carlo, he sent me a transistor radio for my 7th birthday. So what happened? I mean, I could go on and on and on, but the man, and that's why Maya Lansky, when I first met Maya, he flew me down to meet him. I don't know what I was doing, just giving envelopes. But those two created the syndicate. And that's what Vito was so jealous about. He did this while Vito was in jail running his family.
Whispers in the alleys, cameras in the flame, truth and legend tango. Everybody knows the name. Hollywood Godfather on the night, best of 2025. We shine the light from the streets to the stars. Every story alive. This is the legacy. This is the drive.